This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Aaron's back. We talk about the House of the Dragon premiere that we both attended. No spoilers, so don't worry about that. Then, philosopher slash theologian Trip Fuller joins me to talk about Tyrion's final POV chapter. If you're looking for my conversation with Steve about Season 8, or you'd like to hear Steve and I talk about the House of the Dragon premiere, do a search for Double Dragon. Is that a little button on your iPhone that looks like a magnifying glass? Just touch that little magnifying glass and type in Double Dragon. You get to hear Steve complete his journey through Game of Thrones, and you could hear us cover House of the Dragon episode by episode. All right, here is Bosmang Aaron.
We didn't see each other much at the premiere, kind of. Want to hear your experience of it?
Yeah, I was trying to think because I knew I wouldn't be able to say much about it, right? So on the way to the thing, I was like, okay, I'm gonna have like four basic reactions. The first and best would be, this is amazing. It's one of the best premieres I've ever seen.
Yeah, I'm
up there with Breaking Bad, The Leftovers, the original Game of Thrones. Two would be, this is a good pilot that's going to successfully rope any disaffected Game of Thrones fans that might have been inclined to try to give Westeros another shot.
Yeah.
Three, it'd be mildly disappointing, but like maybe not a disaster. Four, it's a complete garbage fire.
Sure.
I think it's definitely the second reaction, which is, this is a good, solid pilot.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's not flat. It's in between the first and second. It doesn't quite get to the highs of like, oh my God, I got, but it definitely, if you feel raw about the way Game of Thrones ended, and I know a lot of people do, mm-hmm. I'm in that camp. I think this is definitely going to, I can't imagine a person, a fair-minded person, watches this episode and, you know, like, fuck it, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, it's just looks like trash. I don't want to see anymore. I don't want to give it a season. I think people are definitely going to be locked in. What did you think?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think when we talked immediately after seeing it, I was kind of like cautiously optimistic. And I kind of felt like both you and Steve were like, oh no, that was impressive. I think your visceral reaction after this was, that was really good. And so,
I was surprised. I was actually thinking it was going to be closer between two and three.
You were bracing yourself.
I was bracing myself for like, you know, well, you know, there's some flashes of good stuff, but there's also like even the, you know, like the Game of Thrones pilot, if you go back and rewatch it.
I was just going to say that.
Cheap looking.
Yeah, it was a little hokey at times. It was, you know, it was definitely enough to hook you in. But if you compare, if you compare like the third or the fourth episode to that pilot, the pilot does seem like it doesn't quite have its tone yet.
No.
This seems like it knows its tone. And this is a grown-up show that knows what it's doing.
I think it's – that's the thing. It's like I want to say it's a stronger pilot, but the thing is it doesn't have, like, Bran getting thrown out of the window. You know, like
spoilers, it does not have Bran getting thrown out of the window.
It doesn't have that kind of like, oh my God, this is redefined. Cause like the thing is, you know, exact, like you have expectations, like Game of Thrones is going to have sex. It's going to have violence. It's going to have betrayals. Mm-hmm. Like we know what this shape is and we know what it feels like. We know what Martin's tricks are. So, and then there's not that there's no surprises.
Yeah. No,
it's
there
just
are, yeah,
nothing
I think
like that. That's like, oh my God, I don't usually watch TV like this.
I think that I tend to agree with you that, well, when I was watching this, I was a little bit worried, cautious early on And then there was
eight. That's a podcaster brain now.
Yeah, right. So then there was a scene. And I think we could talk more about this in a couple months or in a month or so. But
yeah,
there was a scene that was just amazing.
I was the same way.
And I was thinking, wow. I'm impressed.
In fact, from that scene forward, I was just locked into the episode. That's and right. had the podcaster brain had kind of turned off.
That's it. I do want to talk a little bit about expectations, because there's a sense in which, like, if you're like me, you're not, like, you know, used to Hollywood events, you know? So there's a sense in which, because we were invited to this event, we would be way too built up for it. And so the event itself would kind of overshadow the episode. The other way you could look at it is you're thinking, I think this is probably not going to be great, and so I'm going to be happily surprised if it is good. It sounds like you're kind of in the second camp.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I was going to say that, like, my expectations are pretty low until I saw that latest trailer, and then I'm like, this actually looks pretty hot. And I think the Dance of Dragons core Fire and Blood material is good. It's just really dry.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And this, especially when I saw like several sentences, and I would love to give an exact fucking example, but like, you know, like a couple of sentences on the scene, on the page brought the life and not just brought the life, but there's the emotion. Like, they are elaborating on a lot of things. Like, you, it's like if you heard that the, you know, Jaime Lannister was the Kingslayer because he killed his liege lord, all of the realm sees him as a bastard. Now, if you read that like three lines in A History of Westeros, you'd be like, Jaime sounds like a real shit. But like right. By the third season of Game of Thrones, you don't like that. Those three sentences have come to life and they mean something different to you. Yeah. And I think there was two or three instances in this episode where, you know, something happens in the book and it's like a factual thing, but now we see the characters embodied by very talented actors, because I think all the acting was like top shelf in this episode.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a lot of really, I think, good there's some crowd pleasing lines, some badass lines.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that, like, so like my expectations were neutral to positive, and I was going to say it exceeded them. I actually came out here thinking it was going to be like a two to, you know, I was going to have to be like, well, it's just the first episode, and keep in mind, and they got to do a lot of, I actually thought, comparing to the original Game of Thrones pilot, which just piled characters and locations and settings and stuff, like, I felt like this was a lot more accessible because we already know kind of what Westeros is about.
Yeah.
It's a smaller, more intimate kind of setting, because it's like all about the Targaryen family kind of.
Yeah, with this,
there's not like, who the hell is dead and why do we care and who are these people? Oh my god, they're brothers and sisters. Oh, they're fucking, and it feels a little bit more easy to follow too.
It does. And the other thing that this episode does is it really establishes a baseline for just how complex these family dynamics are. There were a couple elements, there were a couple scenes where you're like, that guy is just killing it. That guy is, I will watch every scene with this character in. I am like riveted to the screen. I can't wait to see 10 episodes of that guy doing Westerosi stuff all over the place. I think there's at least a couple characters for me that, like, I will watch the show just to watch that character fly around Westeros, you know.
I'm going to throw one out there. Matt Smith.
Amazing.
That was the one that I was the most worried about, because every time I see him, he's in a tweed jacket with a bow tie and a dorky haircut, and he's holding the Hydro spanner, spanner, whatever the hell the Doctor Who shit is, you know. And every time, like, you know, even in the latest trailer, like, it just wasn't coming together. Like, because this guy's supposed to be, he's just rogue. Mm-hmm. He's this badass. He's a skilled swordsman. He's a real shit, but also there's something about him, magnetic and crit. Mm-hmm. And like, I wasn't thinking Matt Smith. He fucking nailed it, man. He was amazing. He's a beast in this episode, and he does everything that he needed to exactly encapsulate what his character is supposed to be as Prince Daemon.
Absolutely. I was thinking, I think that Jim and Aaron have to include a little Daemon Targaryen in the Badass podcast.
That's a good 60-minute body of work if you're wanting to get to put a badass statement
out
there.
Let me just say, as far in terms of introducing a character into a narrative, the way that he's introduced, the way that that scene is set, the lighting of it, all of that stuff, I just thought, I'm in. This is what I was wanting. You know, I was sort of like, all my expectations, you know, were heightened at that moment. So I can't wait
to see.
And I'll
say this too, like, and we talked about in terms of production value and how cheap the Game of Thrones pilot.
Yeah.
None of this applies. The production design, mm-hmm. I think the Kingsguard looks better than at the height of Game of Thrones series.
Sure.
I think gold cloaks look better than I've ever seen them look. And I think that the locate King's Landing looks amazing. The dragons, oh my God. There is some sketchy dragon work in the middle parts of Game of Thrones. I think these things are rock solid, of course, in the prime of their life. The different locations as we go around, you see them all in the trailer. I'm kind of want to talk about it. Like I'm trying to avoid everything, but it's mm-hmm. like King's Landing, which of course, mm-hmm. but like all the different locations and stuff also look rock solid. And just everybody is just nailing it. Like Patty was Viserys, mm-hmm. Is surprising. From what I've seen, I thought that, first of all, I didn't think we'd see a lot of them. And there's a lot of them. Steve Toussaint as Corlys Velaryon and his mm-hmm. wife, the queen that never was, like those like are very interesting characters, fully realized, like just, you know, it's, and you can see, and that's the thing. I also like, I kind of thought that I would, and maybe I will later in the season have clear rooting interests, because reading in Fire and Blood, I'm like, I'm not sure which of these assholes I want to win.
Yeah.
I thought that I'd come away like thinking clearly, like in, you know, because you get in the end of episode one of Game of Thrones, like Starks are bae, Lannister's shit, and that's like what thing you, I don't know, like I'm really like I'm sympathetic to everyone in the early goings of the show.
I was going to say the almost opposite. That. I was going to say every single person in this show is capable of betrayal, is capable of chicanery.
Sure. But you that know. doesn't mean they can't be my favorite Game of Thrones character.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, right. Hey, what was your feeling of the after party? I thought it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I will say this too, that like I've been on places where it's like a true junket.
Yeah.
And they're trying to just wow you with like, you know, all the thing, you know, the swag bag and this and that. This was not that. This was them. This was a pretty, you know, modest affair by Hollywood standards, is intimate. Like, I think there was maybe what, 300 people, including cast and crew.
Oh, no, it was a lot more. That like the maximum capacity of that venue is 1,000.
Wait, no. What? The theater?
Yeah.
Because like according to Dave Chin, that theater's capacity was like 350.
So they have two theaters.
Uh-huh.
And one is green and one is red. And we went into the red theater.
That holds 1,000 people?
And that holds 1,000. I was thinking that after party was at least 500 people.
Oh, maybe. Well, then you're probably, because I was just gauging on the theater, which was not full. And that's something that I got from, Kim and Kim Renfro and David Chin. They got one turnaround faster than we did. And, you know, she was saying that like the theater, like compared to season 8, where they had the Radio City Music Hall, the whole 2,000 people was jam packed. This was like the however many 500.
Well, if you were going to, I mean, I guess Kim would be the better reporter. Right. So I was just going from the website to see what the maximum capacity was.
Well, they probably just saw the wrong theater because he wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we were in the red one. I thought number one, like when they sort of seated us, we were kind of like in an angle near the front. And I was like, oh, these are kind of crappy seats. But then like, it was a great, like the screen kind of like had that concave effect. the ends were coming a little bit out, so the middle of the screen was kind of pushed back. It was really impressive. I mean, I felt like
a beautiful screen. I was 7 or 8 rows back, right in the center, so I had like Matt Smith was towering, and I thought it was a beautiful theater, great sound.
All right, so let me ask you this. All right, so you're having this experience where you're watching these actors on screen. And knowing that those people are sitting 5 rows behind you.
Yeah.
What? I mean, that's a little weird, isn't it?
It was, but like, I don't know. I don't feel like, like I said, I've definitely felt where people were trying to get me to like something and give, you know, and I thought if that's the case, like, you know, everybody gets a dragon egg and a Targaryen t-shirt and here's a poster and now we need shit. We got a Ziploc bag that we put our cell phones in.
They were really talking up the Ziploc bag too.
But I gotta say that it was like in the after party, it was really cool that like I'm there at the bar and like, oh shit, there's Elon Musk, there's Matt Smith, there's Patty Constantine. I can't pronounce that guy's name. I want to say Constantine every time, and I know that's not.
I say Constantine. I know it's Constantine. Maybe it is.
And Constantine. Okay.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Emma Darcy, is that her? The older Rhaenyra. They're like a lot. Almost all the big name cast were there.
Yeah, yeah.
Ryan Condal, Miguel Sapochnik, the showrunner is there. George Martin himself would have been there had it not been for COVID. Him contracting COVID at San Diego Comic Con, which is a bummer. And they were all just kind of set like you could, we're not supposed to take photos of them, although they did. Matt Smith volunteered to take a selfie towards the end of the night with our producer. But they were all very accessible and it was easy to walk up and say hi. The highlight of me, though, because like I honestly could give two shits about stars. Like I'm glad they're doing what they're doing, but I don't get a visceral thrill. There's some people that I do because I really like their work. But like, you know, I really like talking to my old podcast buddies. I just pretty much talk to Joanna and Kim and Kim's husband, Mike, and Mallory and Jason from the old Binge Mode podcast. They've split and gone their separate ways, but they were all there. And everybody's like, that's the thing about the podcast community is like there's a lot of love there, a lot of support.
It was good to meet Kim for the first time. Like I've interviewed her a couple times, but never in person. So that was really nice. I got to see David Peterson, famous linguist who invented the fake languages. He was there.
Okay, cool. I'm glad you guys got the. I noticed there was some stank put on some of those Valyrian phrases.
I was emailing him afterwards and I was like, I noticed that some of these characters are pronouncing their words a little bit differently than Danny did.
Classic Targaryen phrases.
That's right.
A little bit different. Of course, if you played back stuff from colonial America, it would sound a lot different than nowadays. And it is 170 some years before the classic.
That's game right.
So
I thought that was really interesting because like where he emailed me back, he's like, yep, you know, whenever you see an R in High Valyrian, it ought to be rolled. And so if it's not rolled, that means that character is mispronouncing it. And I thought, this adds a little bit of intrigue because now I got a little bit more insight to Danny's, you know, Danny's not quite, she doesn't quite have a handle on her own history.
She doesn't,
you know?
And why would she, right?
Yeah.
I will say that like already there's also, I mean, you can't say a lot, but there's already them filling in the history of Westeros in a very, what I think is a very satisfying way. And in a way that seems already to piss off the book readers because I was seeing.
There's going to be a bit of controversy.
Some of my tweets launched triple digit lore threads on a song, A-S-I-O-A-F, right? Which Kim let me know is the proper pronunciation of that is Aswaf. So I'm going to be referring to the A Song of Ice and Fire acronym as Aswaf. And r/Aswaf, r/Game of Thrones. And there's a
scene. I don't know. This has an explicit rating, but I don't know if you're allowed to say that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's like a level above explicit.
Well, let me check with one of the Bald Move executive producers. Right. Oh, actually, they're giving me the thumbs up. So,
okay.
What was I saying? You derailed me. There's book fans seething that George Martin is using this tool, and he obviously is, these shows as a way to build his universe that is running, in many cases, ahead of the books at this point. He's like doing new things.
How could they be upset? Like, this is clearly what he, this is what he's been doing for a long time.
Yeah, ever since he inked the deal with HBO. Yeah. No, I don't. I mean,
if you're
don't.
Listening to this and you're yeah, upset right. about that, let me tell you how this works. George figured out a long time ago that he's a producer of content. At this point, he's so much more than an author. You just have to either accept that or walk away. I don't see that there's any other options here.
I think there's just a lot of anger at George not finishing the books. I think there's a lot of anger about how the last time a show ran ahead of his written material, it was perceived as a bad thing. I just think there's a lot of like, and I think, again, to be fair, justified trepidation about a new show that's based on, you know, more. Mm-hmm. I guess that there's it's not just Fire and Blood. There's like what there's two other novellas. I forget exactly what it is that detail a little bit more of this history.
Yeah, there's the Rogue Prince, and then there's the Princess and the Queen. Right?
Princess and the Queen. Those are the ones I was thinking of, and I think that I can understand if I'm a book reader who feels like they've been abandoned by George, that there's a little bit of jealousy that he's playing with his new toys and he's forgotten about us.
Yeah. Well, I don't get the sense that he, I mean, aside from like looking over the scripts and, you know, giving a thumbs up, according to Kim, what Kim told me was, it's not like he's actively writing for the show.
No, but he is definitely giving them ideas and blessing ideas and saying, hey, I've since thought this, and they're right. They're yeah. No, I don't think he'll be credited as a script, but like he is very involved with the history and the lore building.
Yeah. And if that's the case, then I don't have any problem with viewing this as an expansion of canon. It's just,
I just want it to be good. I just wanted to start strong, have a good middle, and finish satisfyingly in three, four seasons, and us all think that like this was a good, solid Game of Thrones project. And by all accounts, by my own two eyeballs, if this is big if,
yeah,
if the entire season is this quality and better, or at least this quality, then I think the vast majority of fans that have decided to come back are going to be pleased, because it does feel like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I think that if you are willing to give this episode a look and you're willing to sit through the end of it, my sense is that you are going to be willing to watch more. Like, this is not going to turn you away. There's at least a couple elements of this that I think will be thrilling, and at least a couple characters that you think, yeah, I'll watch more of that character. This person is intriguing to me.
I totally agree.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, So while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Dr. Trip Fuller helps me cover the final POV chapter in the first book from Tyrion. This conversation picks up as he and I are discussing the upcoming adaptation of Tolkien's work, Rings of Power. Okay, here is Trip Fuller.
I mean, here's what I'll do. I'm going to go into this. I'm going to feel a certain amount of anxiety about it.
Yeah.
I probably will give it a few episodes, and I think that I will be able to sort of step away if I need to.
Okay, well, look, here's the deal, Anthony. Right now, just between me and you, I'm doing a Tolkien class, you know, in August.
Okay.
Called Tolkien Heads. Yes, I do make a parody graphic of the Talking Heads album cover with the color over their faces and put like Gandalf and stuff behind it and put color over their faces.
Very nice. Yeah. I approve.
Doing class with a bunch of Tolkien scholars just so there are people that are interested in me talking about Tolkien so that I can talk with my other scholar friends about the TV show. So I need you to talk to me about the show before you quit watching
it. Okay. Well, I will come on. If you want me on, I will come on. We will talk about it.
No, I want you on. I do want you on. I wouldn't have brought it up. Uh-huh. If I didn't.
Yeah. All right. I'm like I said, I feel like.
But if you don't like it, you might only get 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Like if you start complaining,
Think complaining is good podcasting. And so I try to find, you know, the beauty in it's almost like listening to a sermon for me. I feel like because of my.
What about your student sermon? The first time they preach and they say, Anthony, could you come?
I feel like for me, because of my line of work, it's really hard to listen to a sermon and not like destroy it. So I've had to train myself to not be destructive. And
good
job. So I just try to find like the one positive thing that I can take away. So I think it served me well with things like House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones, things like that. I feel like I'm able to kind of go in and look for the beauty. And, you know, I'll talk a little bit about the things I had problems with, too. But I think that for the most part, I would rather talk about the stuff that I liked rather than sort of dwell on the stuff that I didn't like.
You know, that experience, which, you know, not a lot of people have had, probably listening, if you teach in theological education, right, especially master's degrees, these are people that are doing the degree to be trained to lead a congregation, and then you go see them preach. That's a scary moment, because you know that these individuals felt called in some sense to steward a wisdom tradition and then a community of followers, and they're giving their life to it. And then they sit up there and they're preaching a sermon, probably trying to communicate to the people something that they really believe and want to give their life to in a compelling way. And then you, the professor, sitting there going, that is a horrible exegesis of Romans. There's like just completely wrong. Now, I know you believe, and yeah, okay, that's a good idea here, but it's just bad. And then you had that moment where you go, I'm also critiquing myself. How good am I at my job if this is what my students are doing? You know, it's really painful.
Well, I think I'm helped a little bit in this regard, because a lot of my students come from the Black preaching tradition.
Uh-huh.
And so they're up doing something that I don't know how to do, right? Yeah. Like, even if I tried to stand in a pulpit at a Black church, I could not pull off what they can pull off, rhetorically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I just sit, a lot of times I'll just sit there and just appreciate
the aesthetic side, know,
with a little bit of holy envy, like, oh, that's an interesting approach to this particular problem. I wouldn't have done it, and I probably shouldn't try to do it, because it's just not my culture. But I do know, I think I can sit there and sort of divorce myself from my critical apparatus. Although I'm not sure how we got on this.
Look. But no, it was about how you deal with things you love, and that you've prepared as a scholar to be able to appreciate sermons, even though you know you can deconstruct them as a professional and an academic. You can learn to appreciate them in different ways, and that you might have to pull out that hermeneutic.
Same thing with stand-up comedy. Like, I can sit there and think, that bit was funny, that bit wasn't funny, right?
Yeah.
In addition to all of that, I know that I couldn't do what that person's doing.
Yeah.
So I appreciate what they're doing on stage rhetorically.
What about when the Bald Move Boys keep podcasting about The Walking Dead, even though it's horrible? See, that is a... Like, I couldn't do that.
That is the most beautiful gesture of faith that I've ever seen. Because it's like they're devoted to something that they know deserves deconstruction. So I, you know, again, beauty. I try to capture a little bit of beauty here and there. So Trip, we're looking at Tyrion's final POV chapter in the first book. You're a little bit like Tyrion, aren't you?
Oh, well. Well, thank you.
I didn't know how you were going to respond to that. You could take that in a number of ways, but do you feel a certain affinity to Tyrion as a character?
Well, you know, I don't know really want to share everything I've shared with my therapist about feeling like the overlooked son until things get a serious, serious quagmire, and you realize your prized son might be dying, and his twin sister, who he had incest with, the new king, is doing a horrible job. And at last resort, you realize that there's the short but overlooked drinking and thinking wise one in your midst, and you feel like you must finally leverage the hidden gem of your family. If I was to give details about those parts of identifying with him, it'd get weird.
Sympathy for your therapist, for sure.
Okay. Plus, I'm not going to pay you. So I don't want to burden you with that story. But no, I do. One of the reasons I love the Game of Thrones books is the different chapters take the different POVs, and then it tells you and owns it. Like, in In Lord of the Rings, you always have a POV, a person that's functioning there, but it's almost always the least knowledgeable character so that you're learning the world with them. And one of the things that in Game of Thrones is that the POV character is often very informed and giving you insights to the Game of Thrones that's being played, as opposed to using the kind of ignorance of the character as a device for communicating.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is absolutely that. I think that Martin will do a couple little literary tricks where he'll bring a character from the north to the south so that you can kind of see the south through a northerner's eyes, or bring Kat to the north. I think that Tyrion's the character in all of these books. He's almost always the smartest guy in his chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So with Bran or Arya or Jon or Ned or Kat, you almost get the sense that there are other characters in this chapter that might see things differently. And I might trust that character a little bit more, right? It's like whenever Littlefinger's in a Ned chapter, I'm thinking, well, what is Littlefinger thinking? Because I feel like I would trust Littlefinger's take on this whole scenario more than I would Ned. With Tyrion, I would almost trust Tyrion more than any other person in his chapters to tell the story that's going on around him.
Do you think that part of it is Tyrion's own experience and place within his family, which also puts him in a certain place within battles for power that show up, leads him to have empathy for a whole host of characters that over the time, over the long story, have more and more prime roles.
Yeah, it could be that for sure. I also feel like there's a little element to Tyrion where he has trained himself to observe everything,
mm-hmm.
because he has realized that if I'm going to survive in this world, I need to suss out danger, sniff out danger, whether it's political or, actual. I need to sniff out the political pitfalls of every room I go into. And he's talented at doing it. So I think that there's something about being raised a dwarf in Martin's world that has mm-hmm. sort of given him the superpower of observation.
Yeah. Now, and I know you have a strict form here, Anthony. We're starting to derail from it because I had a thought if we're allowed to chase the comedy bit.
All right, let me read the synopsis, and then we can talk more about that.
I know. I just want to apologize to all your regular listeners. I listen, and I know other guests aren't this rude and derail things, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I just like talking to Anthony, and then he asked about Tyrion, and I realized since we moved, I haven't seen that therapist.
Okay, here's my synopsis. Tywin Lannister and his lords meet at war council in the Inn at the Crossroads. He listens to the accounts of the Battle of Whispering Wood. Then he hears his lords argue about what to do next. When Sir Harris Swift suggests that they sue for peace, Tyrion shatters his wine cup on the floor. He thinks that war was ensured when Joffrey cut off Ned's head. They argue some more. This is when Tywin shouts, "They have my son!" For the second time, Tywin clears the room, save Kevin Lannister and Tyrion. Tywin explains that Renly has declared himself king, and that Stannis is patiently waiting. But Stannis might be the most dangerous person of all comers. Then Tywin orders a change in management. Tyrion will serve as Hand of the King and keep Joffrey in line. He is commanded by his father not to bring Shae to court. Then Tyrion returns to bed where Shae is waiting. He decides to take Shae to King's Landing. So, Trip Fuller, what do you want to talk about? Shall we talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
Ooh, okay. Now, I want to do a theme.
Good.
I want to do a theme.
I love themes.
I want to do a theme. The theme I want to talk about is all the family, the game within the family. In this chapter, you see how the Game of Thrones runs into like just all the family system toxicity of the Lannisters, where their big picture that they have of themselves, like their cherished self image, is running up against the reality of the Jaime and Tyrion and Cersei and Joffrey, like all their character flaws, the ways in which they don't trust their, all that kind of stuff is like brewing this toxic storm that is also generating, right, this giant storm in the big Game of Thrones. But I'd love to hear from you, like what do you see going on just in that family dynamic of the five Lannisters that are either present or spoken of in the chapter?
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about Jaime in this chapter. And I think that there is kind of a brilliance to the way Martin has constructed the family. So there's no doubt that Tywin has the most power, right?
I don't think anyone would disagree with
that. I mean, you could say he's the most powerful man in the kingdom. I think that that would be disputed. But in the family, absolutely, Tywin has the most power. And yet, he's got this major weakness. Tywin's major weakness is that he's got all of his eggs in the Jaime basket. And so Rob has attacked the Jaime basket. He's captured the Jaime basket. And so then Tywin has to kind of look around at the wreckage of his life at that point and think, okay, if I don't have Jaime, what am I working with here? You know, my grandson is a psychopath teenage king. My daughter is trying to rule the kingdom through her son. I don't trust her. I've got this lecherous hedonist in Tyrion. And how do I manage all of this? How do I come out on top when the thing that I most trusted my legacy in is now captured? And I think that you can kind of, it's fun because Tywin's a really smart guy and he's sort of scrambling to figure out what to do with the wreckage of his life.
Even if you think of, there are a couple killings mentioned. One, you get Tyrion talking about, well, you know, if you cut a Stark's head off, you can't like, oh, let's sue for peace. Like you already picked a war because you have Hothead over there. You know, Jaime, the Kingslayer, has created conditions where he thought he was coming into power. Right. So there is some sense there's these connections where when Lannisters overstep their hand, just like, you know, even the pursuit here that gets Jaime captured, it creates problems. And then what is Tyrion's like dig at his dad? Hey, you remember Robert Baratheon? Well, Rhaegar Targaryen's still dead. Like underneath it, it's like you're leading this family and you're turning to me. And I basically all the other ones that you would like to trust first kind of suck. They're not doing very good. And now you're stuck with me. And he forces his dad to call him a son. Right. So you mentioned twice you get they have my son, you know, and then Tyrion's pressing him like, Dad. Like, why do you want me to go be Hand of the King? Because you are my son. And we know that was the subtext of that. The kind of shots you have to get if you're filming it of their faces is a dad begrudgingly calling the son his son. And I just think that all that in there, like they're playing the Game of Thrones and then underneath it, so much of what the whole kingdom is stuck wrestling with the violence and death that ensues is all tied up in this this one particular family who can't even figure out how to be like slightly above average as a family.
All right, I got a question for you about this. All right. So Tyrion is being sent to court to rule, right? And he asked his father why. He says, why not send Kevin? Why not send one of your other lords? Why not send a bigger man? Do you think that Tyrion, I guess this is my first question. Do you think that Tyrion is just trying to get his father to say, like, I'm sending you because you're my son? Or do you think he honestly, like, what are you thinking? Like, you've never trusted me with anything. Why would you send me? Do you think he's just trying to get him to say the words? Or do you think he earnestly doesn't know what's going to come out of his mouth next?
Well, see, here's the way I read it. Now you have me questioning myself. And I only do that once a year. So I read it this way. Like, he wanted him to admit, he wanted his dad to admit that he needed him. And ultimately, all the other options, right, he's giving out, Tywin doesn't really trust them. Because what is it that he really wants? He wants the next generation of Lannisters to perform the idea he has of what it means to be a Lannister. And that is as wealth and power and control. And he wants his son to do it. Because he knows even if he hates him, he loves his brother. And he loves his sister, and they have these complicated relationships, but he knows his son has got these primal wounds that he just wants his dad, his brother, and sister to show some recognition and validation of him. And he knows he's learned what it means to be a Lannister. And if given the power, he's like, you've been watching and learning, and I'll never give it to you. So that's how I heard it, as this going like, you know what it means to be a Lannister. I know you know how to do this. So if I let you do it, you can you can rock it. And he also knows that he's going to show back up there and he's going to take the role. And do you want to go make Hand of the King one of these other people who might be a little depressed when they have to take a step back? But he's already trained Tyrion. If daddy comes calling for your power or sending your whore away or whatever, daddy's going to do what daddy's going to do, and you're going to get over it because you should just be glad I didn't kill you. You know that.
Now, here's the other thing I was thinking. I'm not sure, and I don't think that there's anything that would make me certain about this, but I feel like I am not sure what Tywin really believes about Tyrion's parentage. I think that there's a part of him that wonders, is this really my son? I think that there's a part of...
Because he's confident in how his seed rolls.
Maybe. I don't know what Tywin thinks. I don't know whether he's thinking, well, this is the best I can do because my other son is, you know, captured. Or whether he thinks, this is the one guy I know that will not take Cersei's shit. You know, he's going to go, I need someone to tell Cersei that she's been doing it wrong.
Yeah. Plus if he sent one of the other people, they're going to be like, well, your dad said, and she's like, my dad, you know, but if he says dad said, it's like brother and sister. And,
yeah. They know each other well enough. They can kind of sniff through all of the bullshit.
Cersei would know that if Tyrion's lying, he's dead. Sure. It's like dad's been looking for a reason, you know.
So, well, and I think yes, that's right. And I think that Cersei was as shocked as anyone about what Joffrey ended up doing to Ned. I think she knows that the boy's out of control, and of course Tyrion is really good at slapping Joffrey.
Yeah, like so good you could have a montage.
Yes. So I think that there's something about Tywin where it's very possible that he's saying, you're my son, because he feels like I need to push that button to get this creature to do this action. He's totally manipulative in that way. It's also could be true that he's thinking, well, this may be the best I got. And I think that that's how Tyrion reads it at the end of the chapter. He has this little moment, and I'll go ahead and read it because I own a copy of the book. It says...
What if you were like, I would read it, but I've actually don't have a copy.
I lent my copy. All right. That is when he knew you have given him up for lost, he thought. You bloody bastard. You think Jaime's as good as dead, so I'm all you have left. That is how Tyrion interprets his father's actions. And I don't know whether they're misfiring, if this is really what Tywin thinks. But
because you don't get confirmation.
You don't get confirmation. And I think that Tyrion does not know what to do with his father's praise. I think you almost get the sense this is the first nice thing that Tywin's ever said to Tyrion. Right? Which in and of itself is totally dysfunctional, right?
No, doesn't Tywin from there go to try to get Jaime back? Isn't that where he...
I think that he decided... That's why he doesn't want to go to court.
Right, so that's why I took that as the Tywin actually is going to try to get his son back, so he doesn't really think he's dead or, you know, up for good. That's how Tyrion sees it, because he's like, the only way he would ever do this is if he's dead. But here's the... You tell me what you think of it. This is the other element that made me read it that way. What are the two demands after giving this task to Tyrion? One, Daddy comes in. He has his wine, but untouched. So he's like, Tyrion, I'm going to give you a job, but you see this cup? It has wine in it. I'm not drinking out of it. Sure. Don't be a glutton and a drunkard right now. And then don't take your whore to court. All right? Here's like, you got the brains. You obviously don't have the body and the good looks of your dad, but you got the brains here. You got the name. So what I need you to do is probably not day drink and hang out with a whore.
Yeah.
And then you can fill in for me for a little bit. That was my, like, when I was trying to debate whether he knew or not and, like, what his dad intended and whether his interpretation was accurate. I saw this as, like, I see, yes, you have the ability. I need you not to drink. Don't take the whore. Come on.
All right. I'm glad you brought this up, because I wanted to bring up an email that I got from a very astute listener named John.
Hi, John.
So, John T., if you're listening, this is you. We're talking about you.
No, this is not John M.
No.
Your email didn't get selected, bud.
Sorry, John. John suggests, and this is sort of next level three-dimensional chess stuff.
Ooh.
He suggests that Shay is actually a Tywin plant.
All along.
And he knows that if he says, don't take that whore to court, that what his lecherous son is absolutely going to do is take Shay to court. Oh. And that will allow Tywin to keep an eye on Tyrion. Now, all of this is conjecture, but here's what we do know. At some point, Shay does become a Tywin creature, right?
Yeah.
And so then the question is, when does this happen? And John suggests, well, wouldn't it be an interesting way to read the story if this was a problem from, like, the very beginning?
Ooh. Okay, I think I like that. It makes the ultimate spoiler warning death of Tywin even cooler. If, you know, it wasn't just this kind of betrayal at the end kind of thing, but he'd been being tooled with all the time.
Right.
But also, it's bad since my identification with Tyrion. I got so maybe what my therapist needs to talk to is John and realize that what I thought was like an invitation to really have the identity of son is just part of a deep, deep manipulation. And everyone around me is
so I don't know what to think about this. I feel like I do want to believe that Tyrion and Shay actually have this earnest love relationship at some point. You know,
yeah, because do you think in rereading, I think the genuineness of the love comes through more in the TV show than in the book.
Yeah, it very well could be. I think a lot of people don't like the way that Shay was portrayed in the TV show, but I think that they do some interesting things with her character, and I almost feel like. I'm struggling with whether or not I prefer to see one of my favorite characters actually have love, or whether I want to see one of my favorite books have another level of complication. Because if Shay is always in the bag for Tywin, mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily negate the fact that she falls in love with him. It very well could be that she's a complex creature as well.
Yeah.
Could be that, yeah, I'm a spy. I actually am still in love with you in the same way that John is in love with Ygritte, even though he's a spy, right? Mm-hmm. So again, it's a theory. It's going to be hard to prove this because Shay is dead and Tywin's dead, right? So yeah. How will we ever know?
I think John needs a t-shirt. Do you give t-shirts out to high quality emails? John gets a t-shirt.
John, I don't create t-shirts anymore, so I'll just send you one of my old t-shirts. And hopefully it fits.
It has sweat stains. He uses it a lot when mowing.
Do you just always keep an air horn around just in case you need to praise someone that needs a t-shirt?
I got this new contraption, and it has a soundboard on it. When my Zoom recorder broke, I got a PodTrack mm-hmm. Zoom, and it has sound effects. So they're just sitting there. And, you know, I thought I did pretty good the first 30 minutes we were talking. But
show me one effect that you feel like, when would I ever get a chance to use this effect?
Well, the air horn works good if you mentioned the Clegane Bowl, right? Like, that's what the... But when they're fighting, you play this one. Yeah, Game of Thrones. See, you don't use that one if you're talking about Rings of Power.
No, you can't. You know?
And you don't use this one when you're talking about Rings of Power either. Because you know what Tolkien never puts in his books? A discussion. Like when Tyrion walks in and cups abreast and notes when the nipple gets
hard. No, you'd have to go to Lord of the Rings for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know what that is.
Gosh. You don't know Lord of the Rings?
I was preserving my witness.
All right, so I feel like I've got this wonderful moment to tell a hardcore Tolkien fan about a parody called Board of the Rings. And it is it's funny, but it's also very bawdy. You know, you've got hobbits and elf queens sort of getting mm-hmm. it on and whatnot. And it's absolutely worth looking at, so...
And you're saying this was actually the real inspiration for Game of Thrones.
I can guarantee you Martin's read Lord of the Rings. I think it was written by one of the Harvard Lampoon guys. I'm not positive about that. Mm-hmm. I have to go check that. But anyway, it is a parody. It's totally worth it. I do want to mention one other thing about this chapter. Okay.
Yeah, do it.
So we've talked about Shay. The Mountain actually gets a speaking role in this chapter. I was kind of shocked when I saw it. It's like, oh, the Mountain can talk?
All the eyes.
Here's what he says. He's like, a man who sees nothing has no use for his eyes, the Mountain declared. Cut them out and give them to your next outrider. Tell him you hope that four eyes might be better than two, and if not, the man after him will have six. It's like... When did you learn how to speak, number one? Number two, this is horrific. This is just the first thing that he says. You know, it's like, I've decided to speak up just in this moment to give you my little theory on how to manipulate outriders to do their job by popping eyeballs out and giving them to the next guy.
Yeah, but you have to admit, though, just for his branding purposes, it really is like a good thing to say when you open your mouth. Like, if you're trying to keep your Mountain status, then you hear this and he's like, oh, mm-hmm. you know what Tywin's thinking. He's probably going to go rape and pillage and stuff. And I probably can't outdo those numbers because I can't command. But you know what he can do? Pull eyeballs out.
All right. Notable introductions in this chapter. I don't know. Have we heard about Margaery Tyrell before? This chapter, because I think that she might be introduced the first time.
I didn't know if it was the first time she was mentioned, but just in, like, it is big about the marriage.
Yeah, we absolutely have the introduction to the marriage between Renly and Marjorie, for sure. Vargo Hoat is mentioned in this chapter. Notable departures. The innkeep is swinging from a hangman's line.
Yeah.
So farewell to the innkeep. Differences between the show and the books. I was interested in this line where Tyrion says, you know, this is in response to him saying, you are my son. And he's like, you old bastard, you've given up my brother for dead.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of read the show Tyrion a little bit differently. I kind of felt like when he says, you're my son, it's almost this look of bashful pride on mm-hmm. Tyrion's face. Like, I can't believe he actually said something nice to me. I didn't get the sense that, like, he was quietly judging his father in the show. So, again, subtle, but it actually is quite a big difference for this particular character's motivation.
I definitely think because of the way the death of Tywin plays in the show, people mm-hmm. would resonate more with the ultimate betrayal by Tywin of Tyrion and be like, oh yeah, shoot that fool while he's taking a dump. If Tywin it was understood to have given Tyrion this little bit of hope that, you know, there is some love there.
Right. Right. I think, yeah, it's even then it's maybe like, can you really trust it? Right. So, but
I'm not sure that trust is a category Lannisters sure. use.
Sure.
The one thing we haven't mentioned that I think is funny mm-hmm. in this chapter is the discussion of getting on a boat in the middle of a battle in full armor. And Tyrion being like, you know, basically like, what a dumb dude. He should have drowned.
This guy totally deserves to die. Yeah,
it makes me think of those little bits at the end of G.I. Joe episodes.
Yeah,
you know,
Wonder Girl
like Snake Eye shows up and he's like, these kids are like, wow, it's a down power line that's making light. Let's play lasso with it. And Snake Eyes is like, don't touch down power lines. And they're like, why? You're going to get burned and die. And they're like, and knowing is half the battle. G.I. Joe. Like, yeah. Similar thing. It's like, are you in a battle? Are you going across water towards your enemy mm-hmm. wearing giant metal suit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to get there fast and fight. Don't do it. You could drown. And knowing is half the battle. Game of Thrones.
Oh, man. Oh, that's really good. Okay, well, I totally appreciate it. All right, so how do people find you if they want to hear more Trip Fuller? How do people find your Tolkien class?
So, I mean, they can go to tripfuller.com, trip with two P's, and find the podcast Homebrewed Christianity. I do lots of classes and stuff if you're into philosophy, theology, religion type things. But the next big one is called Tolkien Heads. And if you go to TolkienHeadPod.com, you can join up. And you get to interact with some, like, super Tolkien academics. Then we got four of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, honest-to-goodness, internationally known Tolkien scholars, written major books, won awards for these books. And not just one, not just two. Three legit Tolkien scholars in this class. So you're going to absolutely going to get your money's worth for this.
Well, but I'd also say it's donation based and includes zero, because like you can give money if you want, but you don't have to. So if people just want to go check out the things, they're more than welcome to Tolkien Heads or TolkienHeadPod.com. But yeah, if you go to my website, I'm sure you'll find it. And at some point before you quit watching Rings of Power, we're going to have you on to talk about it, because I, as the optimist in this duo, I think that by the end of the second episode, you will use both of your eyes when watching. You're not going to have one closed.
I hope you're right, man. I absolutely hope you're right about that. Yeah, I'm totally down to participate in whatever way you think that I might be useful.